Welcome to another episode of The Working Title, hosted by PJ Harries.
And luckily, I've got to a point where I kind of know what I'm doing, so if this audio don't come out, we can just delete it all and just pretend we have chat.
Okay, Roger.
Awesome. So, welcome to The Working Title, guys. Today on the couch, this feels like the casting couch, but it's a bit creepy, is James Hancock. He's a troop commander in the Royal Logistic Corps Reserves. And he sort of does project management based stuff with a bank part time, or this is part time, or that's full time. who really knows? And the reason I've got him on is a childhood friend. We've known each other for a long time now. But he's got a very interesting story, which includes leaving school with no qualifications at all, growing into, actually, no, probably the opposite of growing. Because you were really fat and then you weren't so fat and now you're sort of almost fat. And then going into the reserves, deciding to take the officer route and making sort of waves with life as you are now with different businesses and a wife and a kid on the way. So, James, introduce yourself, mate.
Mate, lucky the world knows about the kid on the way. I wish I'd just announced it to the whole world.
Well, if not, we could have deleted it.
Pretty much what you said, mate, to be honest. So, 31, just turned 31. Don't feel 31.
Definitely look it.
Definitely, oh, mate, have you noticed? I've been bad at some of
the
eyes.
The crow's feet, I'm not even joking. The crow's feet.
I saw the squinting. Also, I don't wear glasses anymore. There's another improvement.
You've got laser?
No, got contacts.
Oh, nice.
Best decision ever, mate.
Moves up in the world.
I know. Just as you said, mate, really, just cracking on with life. Worked for a big bank. Work for the army, and I do treat it as work. I massively treat the army as a reservist. I essentially think I work part-time in the army. Wife, which I owe a lot of my success to. Been with her 8 years last Saturday. You were there at the start.
Time has flown, mate.
When I paid us £100 each or whatever it was to get into Mayhem nightclub on New Year's Eve so we could go and see her. You and Zach. That's it. And you're right, mate. Just trying to fly through. Lots I've done. I think, like, for me, this is a mega opportunity to sit and reflect. I've always joked to people that I reckon I've got, and I don't want this to sound arrogant, and I say this quite a lot, I reckon I've always got a good story to tell people, but purely because it's a story that I think anyone can do, and I never understand when people can't do something that I've done. I've never done anything mega. I never have, and I don't understand when people say I can't do that. So
I think, mate, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to get you on. And I'm very lucky to be part of, if you like, a veteran community.
Yeah.
I don't know why I just did the old, inverted commas with my fingers, because no one can see it, but...
Seven kicks to freedom.
Yeah, exactly.
6 years, mate.
I'm very lucky that there's a lot of blokes in your position. Now, that's not saying that only the people from the military world are like that, not at all, but that's just where my experience has come from. And they live a life, and it's only at the end of it, or when they sit down and come on the podcast and stuff, that they reflect and go,
yeah,
actually, this is a story. Most of them, I've asked blokes to come on, or girls to come on, and they've gone, what am I going to talk about?
Yeah.
And I explain the talking points I want to have a chat with, and they go, oh, fuck yeah, I'm actually a bit of a legend. So, that's exactly it, mate. So we might as well start from the beginning. So young James grew up around the South End area.
Yeah.
Tell us about that, mate. Tell us how you found school, what that was like growing up.
Yeah, so I was one of those that was lived in three-bedroom terrace house, centre of South End. Both parents worked, fairly decent jobs. Things went a little bit awry in family life when I was 9, 10 years old. And pretty much that's probably what set me off on that wrong path. And I look back now, and when I had my 30th last year, and Nikki, my wife, did the party, in one of the restaurants in South End, she put pictures up. As an 8, 9 year old, I was a fairly normal 8 or 9 year old size. And then there was pictures of me when I was like 13, 14. And I was like, I remember being 15 stone by the time I was 15 years old. I don't want to blame a lot of stuff, but I would probably say that probably because of the home life situation, and it's only the same home life story that 50% of this country have. It's nothing, you know. Bloody hell, probably we can name all our mutual friends, and I'd probably say 50, 60, 70% of them have got a similar home life story. But I obviously chose to start comfort eating and just really fucking up in life. I probably had potential at school, and that's my biggest regret. So I went through school all the way through to year 11, and essentially, you know, that was back in the mid 2000s, 2005, where, you know, the country at the time, everyone was walking away with A's and B's and C's and GCSEs. Mm. I essentially walked away with a couple of C's in maths and English, and thank God, and I'll explain that a bit later. Luckily, I had those C's in maths and English when it comes to the army. I begged my way back into sixth form, promising the head of sixth form that I would resit all my GCSEs in that year, which I didn't. So I got kicked out. So essentially, I got kicked out after year 11 and begged my way back in. I did year 12, and then at the end of year 12, I'd not done any of those GCSEs, and I'd got U in all my AS levels. And I remember sitting and having the exact same conversation with the head of sixth form, and I said, can I retake the year? And she looked at me and went, like, you're going to be like a 19-year-old year 12, 18-year-old year 12. I went, yeah, happy with that, crack on. And I remember there was a little bit, I had a really good couple of months. I just turned 18, I was in year 12, and I had a really good couple of months at sixth form at Tommy Moore. And I thought, oh, yeah, I'm really getting this education piece. And then I can't remember exactly what happened, I just totally went off the rails again. And then when it came to that following August, for the third time, I think all my goodwill had run out at school. So I remember rocking up on a Thursday morning for results day, seeing the three or four U's and the zero in the GCSE marks. And then I just cruised straight over to the bank, which was, I know, always employing. And I said, I need a job. So that way I went home to a really disappointed mum about school. But I said, look, I've tried to fix it. I've gone and got a full-time job, essentially. And yeah, that was since my school years. There wasn't really anything notable. I think one of the biggest issues I had is I grew up a bit too quickly, too soon. So when I was about 14, 15 years old, I got in massively with the wrong crowd in a football environment. So I spent literally the weekends travelling up and down the country, being absolutely penalised for following Southend United all over the country, following England home and away. I say with the wrong crowd, but some of these were top people, like, and, you know, I'd still go for a beer with some of them now, but there was an incident recently, about 2 or 3 years ago, where 12 people were convicted of serious assault and violent disorder in Southend after a Southend United match. And when I read it in the paper, 10 of those used to be my really good friends, and we've got a mutual friend, Woody, and I won't say his full name because he's a copper. And I remember saying to him at the time, I said, my God, imagine if I'd still been with these people. Yeah. That probably would have been me. But yeah, well, we'll come on to that later about a bit of a change of direction. But yeah, that was my school years, really. I wasn't there as much as I should have been, and I definitely wasn't there for the exams mentally and probably physically as well.
Yeah, awesome. What I'm going to do is when I post this up on the Insta, I'm going to find one of those old pictures of you. Like, I've got quite a few stowed up.
Yeah, and I've got like, some good ones.
Side by side like then and now, so people get context of what you're talking about. Awesome, mate. So I think, yeah, as you say, it's not an unfamiliar story for a lot of people, especially coming from the sort of military world. There'll be loads of lads out there now that are thinking, yeah, actually that resonates quite a lot. And especially the sort of wrong crowd thing, whether that's based around football or a deprived area, that kind of stuff, that's quite relatable. When you sort of were getting into work and you'd started work, luckily you got that break with the bank, and you pretty much, that's where you started to find your niche, wasn't it? Because you were there for a long time, but your work ethic and your ability to adapt and learn is what carried you through that, rather than your qualifications.
Yeah. So I think, and negated to mention something, I think that was really key that we've got in common, and I think many of the people that we know have got in common, that was Air Cadets.
Yeah.
And I know when Jack was on this, I know that Jack brought up as well. Yeah. So for me, there was something that was a bit of a constant in the background, that while school was failing, while home life wasn't, you know, great at the time, and, you know, my mum's done a fantastic job bringing me up on her own now. Air Cadets was a massive constant, and really between that, like, late teenagers, 16 to 19, that is what started converting a bit of my work ethic. And you're right, and then I kind of took that into the bank. So I started off in the bank as a nighttime call worker, lowest of the low, literally working 7 hour shifts for something like £7 an hour or £6 an hour, whatever the minimum wage was back then. And then, yeah, something clicked maybe 6-12 months in, and I was enjoying having, you know, as any 19-year-old would, having 1200 quid in your bank account, you know, every month or whatever. But it was good because it was like you could see the results, so you could see that actually digging in and kind of like regging out 7 hours a day, 5 days a week was equals £1,200. And money, I say money, not like a motivator now, but it does make the world go round. And, you know, I'm much prefer to be unhappy with money and than not. And that was kind of my mantra back then. So, yeah, 1920. But the only problem was, like, I was starting this, like, job, or I probably didn't see it as a career at the time. In my head, I always wanted to join the military. So, as you know, and, you know, most of our friends did, and that, that's mm-hmm. probably why we've got similar mindsets. But the problem is, as, like, I ate a lot and I put loads of weight on through school, I probably put even more weight on once I started working at the bank.
Because you had money to buy more food.
That is essentially it.
And alcohol. Honestly, there was a lot of alcohol that went down range.
Lots of champagne, or cheap champagne. Yeah. I remember, why would we even do that?
Big time in it, just
big
because...
Big time in it, 1,200 quid a month. Yeah,
for that weekend.
Yeah.
And then it was all down. So, this was 1920, and you were sort of on that journey, and you say one of the sort of things I wanted to go into was the armed forces, always a goal for you, and I think most of the people that went to cadets, not all of them, now air cadets is a weird one, like it's only in reflection that I realise how understood it is from the outside in.
Yeah.
So we have both got, again, in common, the two people that ran that squadron at the time are nothing short of parent figures for every single kid that rolls through that place, mm-hmm. especially in our era.
Yeah.
And I personally owe a lot to them, to where I am now, what I did. And I think everyone who's, you know, who could dedicate that to something has something to owe to those two. And if they ever listen to this, I'm sure they'll know who we're talking about.
I'll get tagging later. I'll make sure they hear them. Exactly. Name check them.
So, you know, those two, and obviously the other supporting staff as well, had a massive part in what we developed and sort of became. When you were in that environment, and I say it was underestimated because everyone used to think, as air cadets, you were the goodest of the good, you were the geeks, you were that sort of thing. And we could play on that, especially when it comes to staying away with parents and stuff. It was like, oh, it's an air cadet thing. Oh, sweet, crack on, have fun. And you're like, nice. But anyway, like, it's a very understood thing, and now reflecting, I think it's a great avenue for people to go into. So when you were going through that process and you were still in that world and going into the instructor phase, was the military still a goal for you? Did you pick a branch? Were you aiming for something?
Yeah, massively. So I think I remember the annual squadron dinners.
Yeah.
And we won't talk about the last one that I remember you went to.
Well, let's just say I won't invite too many more after.
The thing for me was that I remember leaving mutual friend of ours, Tom, and he joined one of the forces.
Yeah.
And we did up and did a little speech. And I remember at the end of it, he said, oh, I'm off to do this. And there was another person there, and she was off to do that. And he turned around and said, James, you'll still be here. And I was just like, oh, I don't want to still be here. But I just ended up transitioning to that kind of instructor thing. And for me, I lent into it thinking it was a really professional outfit, because that's what I'd seen as a cadet. And the reality is, and this is not to discredit any of the volunteers that run like in cadet forces and that, it wasn't what I wanted. It wasn't that challenge what I wanted. And it took me 3 or 4 years to understand that. So that's when really I kind of decided that I was taking the right route in civvy life, and I'd probably taken that route well enough that it was now paying a really good income. And because I didn't have any qualifications, my options were then limited in joining the military full time. Mm-hmm. So I set my eyes on the goal in 2014, essentially joining the reserve. And that's when the government released the new reserve forces, so not the TA, not the Royal Auxiliary Air Force, whatever they are. It was all about being a part-time soldier and like a professional. And I was like, yeah, I fancy a bit of that. And essentially, that's what started triggering my change of attitude in this space, you know, fitness, health, all that stuff had to happen.
So you say that was about 2014, because I can't, in my mind, really remember when you did essentially lose all that weight.
Yeah, it just happened to me.
I remember it happened quick.
Did it?
But for me, it was always, I never really saw you like that anyway. Like, we were always mates and always got on really well. So although the one of the only things we didn't have in common was the fact that I was always training from a young age with rugby and MMA and stuff anyway. So fitness for me was always just what I did. So that's something that we didn't have in common, but it never really mattered because the circles we ran in, what we did together, it didn't really influence it.
Yeah.
And I think it was probably about that time that I was preparing for the Marines or early stages, that sort of thing, that it sort of really came for you as well. Because I remember it wasn't long after then that we not grew apart at all. It was just that we were both busy.
Both had different things on, didn't we?
And that's when my business started, was when I started in the protest with the Marines, you know. So talk us a bit through how that happened, how that, because it was a massive transition, you know. You were at one point, what, you'd like 22 something stone,
well, the heaviest? So yeah, so 23 stone 12 was the heaviest point. I can gladly say I'm 85, 86 kilos now, 13.7, 13.8, and I've pretty shit bust been that for 7 years, touch wood, since I went for selection for the army. I think, so there was a couple of really key things that really switched my mind, and one of them was pretty much all my mates joined the forces,
mm-hmm.
and I was stuck in Southend, or I was working for the bank, and I was doing really well, and I was on a great income, and I was seeing people that I'd gone to school with come back from university working for me,
yeah.
and I just kept thinking, ha, look at you, you went and did education, and it's not paid off for you. But then I always then thought, shit, all my mates have left, joined the forces, and you know, you're right, we didn't catch up a lot, and that's all of us, because everyone just took different paths, yeah. and when you're in either basic training through the way to your first posting, that's 2 or 3 years of your life just gone like that. So the key thing is I saw that happening, and I definitely wanted a piece of that. The second bit is I met Nikki, and I actually met Nikki after I'd started gradually losing the weight. But she didn't care, like, so she must have met me when I was 18 or 19 stone, so I'd lost 3 or 4, but anyone that's been that big knows that you lose that first 3 or 4 pretty quickly, like, if you change your lifestyle habits. And then the other key factor was I remember going to a Christmas party, but it was in January for the bank, and I was struggling to find a suit that I could hire because it was a black tie event, and I had to go and find a 52-inch waist pair of trousers and a 60-inch chest jacket.
And that wasn't because you had a big chest.
No, mate. I wasn't even dench back then. And I was like, I just kept going to these places, and yeah, like, people stock that stuff. And I look at it now and I think, my God, I used to genuinely fit in that. And I went to the event and I walked up the stairs and it was snowing. It was the night before my 22nd, 21st, which was 2011, 2012. And this is kind of what changed it, in conjunction with everything else. And I was walking up these stairs at Stockbrook Manor in Billericay.
Yeah.
And it was snowing, and I got up to the top of the stairs and I was sweating and out of breath. I thought, this is bollocks. Like,
that's not a massive building, mate.
No, it's not. When I say steps, there was 20, 25, like, and had a massive night, drunk loads. I remember downing a bottle of rosé, like, because I was the party guy and all of that. And I woke up the next morning and thought, bollocks, let's change. And I just did. You know, but I didn't change, like, massively. I didn't, like, start smashing out, like, salad and steak and broccoli and rice. And I say that when I've got my lunch sitting in front of us here.
Of exactly what you just said, yeah.
Yeah, so, but I wasn't doing that. Like, all I literally did was, like, where I used to, like, when I learned to drive, I used to, like, go and get petrol on a Sunday night. But instead of going to get petrol, I said to my mum, oh, yeah, I'm off to go get petrol. I then go via McDonald's at the airport after just having dinner. Like, because, like, that's what your body was. You had 22, 23 stone. Your stomach's massive. It needs filling. Like, that's the reality of it. So I just ate less. I still didn't eat, like, nutritionally great, but I just ate a lot less.
Yeah.
Joined the gym. And anyone in Southend knows the old Fitness First down Victoria Avenue. Well, I used to live in Colchester Road, which is probably about 180 to 200 metres from
it. Yeah, it's like round the corner, isn't it?
Round the corner, yeah. I used to drive to that gym. Can you imagine? I used to drive to that gym. And I used to get on the treadmill, and I remember I used to do 2 minutes on the treadmill, like walking, 2 minutes rest, 2 minutes walking. But actually, that, with a little bit less food, the more I moved, the less I weighed.
Mm-hmm.
And the less I weighed, the more I moved. It was such a simple thing. And then over about 2 years, 2.5 years, I kind of realised that I could get fit and healthy, and that wasn't such a hard thing to do. And I did it all myself. There was no Weight Watchers, Slimming World, nothing like that. I just learned to eat less and move more, and being hungry is okay sometimes. And even now, like, being hungry is okay. Like,
it's that calorie deficit, and there's so much crap out there that people go, you need to do this, you need to do that, you need to do this. And I think the only bloke in the big fitness space that's just saying it for real is that James Smith PT, have you seen
him? Yeah.
And he literally just says it, harps on about it, you know, it is that easy.
Yeah.
Energy in versus energy out.
Yep.
And exactly as you said, ate less, moved more.
Yep.
Bang, simple as that.
And it honestly was. And I think it was only, so then after being with Nicky, like for about a year, I said, look, this is what I want to do now. I want to join forces in the new reserve. And she was so fully supportive of it. You know, I was instructed with the air cadets, but I didn't spend any time away, really. It wasn't like that, was it? You know, it was the odd Fridays and Sundays, but it was nothing, you know, you'd still go home and whatever. But she was fully supportive. But then I remember then, pretty much New Year 2013, so the end of 2012, 2013, I've got a goal. And I started realising that to achieve what I wanted to do, I just had to have a goal. Mm. And I knew that the BMI entrance to the army, as in for army development selection centre at Purbright, you had to have a BMI of 28 or less, otherwise you had to rely on a waist measurement. And I remember saying to myself, well, that's 13 stone 6 pounds. So I had a target to get to 13 stone 6 pounds the day before selection. So went for all the selection, and I got to ADSC, and my BMI came at 28.1, and I was in a tracksuit bottoms and a top, and I said to the nurse, I went, and if anyone that's been through forces selection, you know it's exactly the same in med center. I said, sorry, I've got to take my clothes off. I said, oh, trust me, I know I'm 13.6, and I took the clothes off, and I come in at something like 27.8 or 27.9, yeah. And then, I don't know, I guess having that target was the massive thing on... you know, for me, that was the key thing. That's what drove that first initial weight loss and fitness bit. I don't know how else to describe it, really. It was just having that goal, making sure I had something to achieve, and like having a real hard target to do. That was the key bit.
So once you got into that lifestyle and you started making that big differences, and obviously the end goal and what you were aiming for was the Army Reserve fitness standards and that health standards. Did you have any other goals? Obviously, you did a lot of running.
Yeah.
And then went into boxing later on. But what was your sort of, where did the sort of like the long distance runs, where did that come in terms of your application process? Was that on the way? Was that why you were in? Was that part of the journey?
So.
Or just Woody's fault?
No, so I was about to say. So I've got two things there. So going into selection centre and like for me, army or forces selection, okay, not the Marines, not the Paras, not any of the, you know, the T-Farm units, is a very, very easy baseline now for me to achieve because I'm the other side of it. Mm-hmm. So I'm now beyond that. I'm sure anyone that's listening or anyone goes, that's not easy for them to achieve those baseline standards. But Woody, in the summer of 2013, got me into running. And I said to him, mate, I can run a mile and a half. He was like, oh, good lad, come for a run. And I remember we did 2.2 miles three or four times a week. And then the following week, in that summer of 2013, we then did like 2.5, 2.8, then we did 3, then we did 4, and then suddenly it was like, mate, you can run 5 miles, and I was like, oh, mate, that is unreal, and before I knew it, I was running 5 miles, and it might have taken 45, 50 minutes, which, you know, is probably a fairly good time, but, you know, I was like, wow, I could do it. When I went to selection centre, though, in the December 2013, during the medical, they found that I had a leaky heart valve, and everything I built up for, and I I've seen the goal at the end of it was essentially taken away from me, and they said, no, you're probably not medically fit to join the armed forces, and I was gutted. So I had a really good Christmas, and I think I probably put on about 6 or 7 pounds and I drank loads or whatever, but I wasn't going to take no for an answer. I went and found out what routes I could still explore, and essentially I managed to go and see the chief cardiologist in the army in the April or May in 2014, who said, no, what you've got is what 1 in 3 people in this country have got. It's more than normal. It's just you've had your heart scanned, no long-term problems whatsoever. So he wrote me a letter. So then I had another goal again to go back to selection centre in the June. So then that was my fitness goal then.
Yeah.
So I'd like, well, didn't get in 2013. So 2014 in June, had another fitness goal. I found out, and Nicky and I were on holiday in Agadir, I remember it. And I was still running every day in anticipation of going back to selection centre. And then I remember an email come through and said, oh, we can offer you a selection centre next week. I was like, yeah, go for it. Because I knew I had to be 13 stone 6 again. I knew I had to be fit. And then once I passed selection centre, it was then, what's the next goal for me? And I thought, well, what have I always wanted to do? I thought, oh, no, I want to run the London Marathon.
Mm-hmm.
So in between like June 2014 and April 2015, I was like, right, that's my next goal. I'll do basic training. So I went to Purbright for 3 or 4 weeks back then on the old reserve training, which was like a bit of a back-to-back thing. Smashed that, came runner-up for best PT in the troop that I was in. So I was like, yeah, this is great. Started seeing the opportunities the Army's had for fitness as well. But yeah, I thought, oh no, what do I do now? I'm in the Army as a reservist. What's my fitness goal now? Other than doing a fitness test every year, what's my thing? So Woody and I sat down, and Woody, you're getting the main checked a lot on this, mate. We sat down and I was like, oh, let's run the London Marathon, let's do it. And we did. And I entered Charity Place under the Army Benevolent Fund, and I thought that was appropriate at the time, so I just joined up. And Woody ran it for a charity close to his family. And then that took care of that 6 or 7 months then before the marathon.
Yeah.
That was for me, it was like, bang, got a goal, do it. We run it in, I think it was 4:55 we run it in. Probably 25 minutes slower than we wanted to first time. But, you know, Woody and I are out 3 or 4 times a week, training buddies, you know, doing the long 20-mile runs around Southend, Rayleigh. I loved it.
The journey together as well as the final product, wasn't it?
Definitely. Like, I got injured on our last training run at about 20, 21 miles. Funnily enough, outside of KFC down the A127, I just like saw all my great history coming back to me. I was like, no, it's done me again. And Woody was like, oh, let's stop. I was like, mate, you go on, brother, you go on. And he went to finish. And during the marathon, you know, we support each other as well. You know, he struggled in some areas, I struggled in some areas, as anyone would that probably runs a marathon. And then, yeah, it was great. But also we had a fundraising target as well. So there was also the pressure of doing it for a charity, doing it for everyone. I mean, we had about 20 people there that day following us around, like all the stops at the marathon. Yeah, so that was great. So that's the running bit. And then since then, I've just always looked for that next thing.
And on that, so you were, how old were you when you sort of run the marathon and you were just sort of past selection and starting your reservist journey?
25, 26.
You were still relatively young. Yeah. So essentially realise a big thing in your life that you're starting to know yourself. You're starting to learn that for you to achieve stuff and to keep pushing forward, you need that next goal.
Yeah.
Now, is that something you realised at the time, or is that something that now, looking back, you're like, that's what I was chasing?
Yeah, right. So the way I look at it is that consciously I had that goal to join the Army as a reservist, and then consciously I had the goal to run a marathon. So I adapted my lifestyle for that. And I think, fuck, imagine if I'd had that goal or had those goals when I was 14, 15, 16, 17. I imagine if I was one of those blokes who actually had an education as well as a bit of motivation. And that's all it is, a bit of motivation.
Well, you'd be an astronaut now.
Mate, of course I would. But like, yeah, you'll be working for me.
Tim Pigg would be there, mate. Awesome, mate. So you sort of, let's carry on the timeline then. You're starting out in the Army Reserves.
Yeah.
You're getting into the squadrons and stuff like that. So how does it work? I've got a basic idea, but I'm trying to do it as if I had no idea.
Yeah.
How does it work in terms of, if you go into a reservist, do you pick a regiment, a squadron, or do you have to go to a local one? What's the sort of route there?
Yeah, so like that, turning this into recruitment for the Army Reserve, which I might do if you put this up on Twitter. I'll tag the CO and RSM in this so they can share it. So since like the new Army Reserve was established, like it's all about one army concept. So for me, there's an opportunity. I mean, like I won't give away our exact location, but if you just look outside the window, you'll see all our trucks and all our kit and equipment all lined up ready to go. Because we're in a unit that's part that all backs into, oh sorry, all about using the terminology, that supplements a regular unit. So there's a lot of opportunity, and that's why I chose the unit that I'm part of now, purely because I knew there was going to be a lot of opportunity here, because we actually backfill a fairly active unit in the regular army. So we're always paired to whatever they do, whatever we do, they do. So that's why I chose here. Now, I will say in hindsight, I probably wouldn't have chosen the trade that I went into.
Right, yeah.
I was probably really green and naive back then, and you know, a little bit wet behind the ears, and I thought it was all about soldier first, and trade. Actually, the reality of the forces is that those that have trades, the trade does take prominence, and if you want to be a soldier, you go to a tea farm, which is absolutely fine, but kind of what I found was that I could become, and be careful, once again, not sound arrogant, but just say that anyone could do this, is that I become a fairly decent soldier in this type of unit, because it was easy to do that, as long as you're fit proactive and they've got a bit of motivation. And once again, as I said, I can't understand why no one can do that. If you want to be fit, you go and run more.
Yeah.
If you want to be motivated, you just look at a goal. Like, so I couldn't quite, you know, accept the situation I was in. And yeah, I went through, got all my trade qualifications, got all my licenses, got everything. But I really enjoyed the soldiering. Like, mm-hmm. I really enjoyed the soldiering. Essentially got promoted within the first 18 months, 2 years. Got selected for promotion to Lance Jack. And come away with best section commander on a PNCO, on like promotion course and everything. Because it was purely field-based. It was purely soldiering. I loved it. So in between that, though, I had my next goal. And my next goal was, what can I do that someone probably hasn't done in the Army Reserves?
Mm-hmm.
And it was box. So the Army Reserve offers everything, right? But to box in the forces, you pretty much got to go into a training camp for 6 to 8 weeks.
Yeah,
I'm sure as you know. And pretty much if you're a BOD, you get taken out of your unit.
Yeah, and you go to training camp, yeah.
Train, eat what you like, go for runs, go do coaching, probably go back and do some of your work during the day. So it was quite hard, but I put my hand up, I was like, come on, let's do this. And because we were paired with a unit at the time up in Oxfordshire in Abingdon. And I was like, yeah, let's do this. And that was the January 2016. So I'd done selection, joined the army, done basic training. My next goal was a marathon. After finishing marathon, I was like, what's next?
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, I'm going to box my regiment. It's going to be great. And it's going to be everything I want it to be. And, you know, after that, I'm going to take it on. Really, it is. I work full time for a bank as well.
Yeah.
So I couldn't just go on to training camp for 6 or 8. So I spent 3 to 4 months, just before Christmas and just after Christmas 2016, essentially like going to boxing down at the locker room down in Southend, like 3 nights a week, completely doing my own fears, doing my own training. And then when it came up to like fight week, I had to go for a couple of matching bouts. So essentially just make sure the guy I was facing wasn't
going to spank
me in the ring. Yeah. And then did it and then boxed and went to the finals night, you know, a few hundred people, 2 regiments fighting each other. And then I was kind of a guest on their scorecard. It was fantastic. I loved that. So I thought, yeah, I fucking love this army life. But the problem is I was trying to live a life of a single regular army soldier with a house and a mortgage.
Yeah.
I was engaged, full-time job, everything else. So, yeah, so that's kind of where it got. And then it kind of all culminated in what my next goal was.
Awesome. So, yeah, it's important to note that when we're building up like that and we're sort of, you're bracketing it, and we have to do that, otherwise you can't get any of the story out. And obviously, it's a podcast about everything, so we can't delve as much into each of the different details as we want. And there's so many stories for each and so many lessons for each. But I think the overarching thing is that we're developing a trend here that, you know, you've realised that you need to set a goal. Once you set a goal, you can achieve it. It's that hard work, that dedication, that personal character that's pushing you through these points. But it's also worth knowing that at the same time you're doing all this with the Army Reserves, with all this in fitness, you're actually doing quite well at the bank as well.
Yeah.
You're moving up the ranks, you're earning more money, you're getting busier with work. And we will go into it a little bit later, so I won't harp on about a bit how you do that balance. But let's stick with the theme at the moment. The next goal, which is Sandhurst, wasn't it? You sort of made that decision. What did that... You know, why did you think, especially because you were just saying you wanted to be a soldier, and then you're going into a regiment that doesn't do a lot of that type of field soldiering, and then you want to go into a job within that regiment that does even less. What's the methodology behind that?
Yeah, I'm going to be honest, but I'm going to be political at the same time, just in case any of my
smart
superiors listen, but they're well aware of my ambitions. So, So that was it. So I've come off like being promoted to Article Corporal, you know, boxing regiment, and I just had this great week. Get annual exercise. I went to annual exercise, and the new CO was there. The new CO's like came and jumped in essentially my wagon for the 2 weeks, and I just fed back to him what my thoughts were on where we were and what we're doing as an Army Reserve and stuff like that. And he went and wrote a paper for the brigade based on like an insight of a soldier, and he said, God, you should think about being an officer. And I said, you know what, sir, fantastic, but I've literally got 2 GCSEs. I don't even meet the minimum requirement for a serving soldier to commission, which was 5 GCSEs, or still is 5 GCSEs. But it put it in my head. So I got back from exercise, and I just thought, I'll look at policy, and I'll see what the policy is. And the policy was, you had to have 5 GCSEs as a serving soldier and serve 3 years. And I thought, But it said this little thing underneath. It said, or have a waiver from an army education centre. Now, as I said, like, luckily working for a bank and that, you know, gives you a set of skills of numeracy, literacy, decision making, judgment making. I knew how to write like briefing papers in a civvy sense. And I thought, well, I might not have got the physical piece of paper that says I did the education, but I reckon I can turn what I've done vocationally in the bank into something. And yeah, we'll talk about bank a little bit later, but you know, I'd like, at one point, I had like 180 staff for me in the bank. Like, I was the equivalent of essentially nearly a CO in a small regiment, like in the army or Marines or whatever. And I was like, oh yeah, okay. So went and challenged policy, went and got the medical done, was wary of the whole leaky heart valve thing, went to a med centre. They tried to downgrade me at the med centre, the leaky heart valve.
Again,
for the second time, and I sat there and I said, nah, not accepting it. I said, I want to speak to an RMO, regimental med officer. Got a second opinion, the RMO was like, nah, it's absolutely fine. Got a green stamp, I was like, fucking hell. The only thing that's now out of my hands is a pass. So I remember driving back from Invicta Barracks in Kent, like punching a seat and going, fucking hell, I might go to Sandhurst here. Put the application in, got sponsorship from a current regiment, which essentially gives me a return of service, which is why I'm here. So there's other units I probably wanted to join at the time as a second lieutenant, as a troop or platoon commander, but I'm still doing my return of service at the moment.
For that sponsorship.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially the unit I want to join, there's a certain select criteria to be there. Probably one that you don't like, because it's a real man's badge opposed to one of those knife things.
Oh, really? Interesting.
So yeah, so did that. Went to, so put the application in, got approved, went to Army Officer Selection Board, and I thought, bloody hell, no one's even questioned the fact I've got two GCSEs here. So Army Officer Selection Board's in two parts. It's called a briefing, which is a 2 or 3 day, and then there's main board, which is a 4 day. I went to briefing. No one questioned my qualifications at all. I was like, yeah, cheers, easy. I come away with what was called a Cat 2 out of 4. So Cat 1 is, yeah, you cleared straight attend. Cat 2 was, you're cleared to attend, but you're not physically ready.
Right.
Which I couldn't understand in my head, but I'll explain that and say it. Cat 3 is don't come back. Cat 4 is definitely don't come back.
Yeah.
So I've got a Cat 2 because at Army Selection Boards, you only have to reach 10.4 on the shuttle runs, 44 push-ups, 50 sit-ups, whatever it was. Blitzed all that. There's one thing I didn't know about, which was an obstacle course, like a little individual obstacle course.
Yeah.
And when I mean individual obstacle course, for anyone in military, it's not like a proper obstacle assault course. It's like go to a playground and jump over a few blocks and swing on a rope type obstacle course. And you only have 45 seconds, 50 seconds to complete it. Well, there was these hurdles and you had to jump over 2 hurdles. And it's all about, as an army officer, you've got to show agility. And I've never hurdled. So in my eyes, I attempted these hurdles and I run at them like figuratively, not metaphorically, literally, not metaphorically, run at these hurdles. In my head, I must have just clipped them, but I think back in looking at it, I must have just run through the fucking thing.
Like, smash them spaces.
And I literally got a 6-month deferral because of that. And I was like, nah, I'm not having it. So, come back, and I was like, because I wanted to get on the commissioning course at the back end of 2018, and if I had a 6-month deferral, I was never going to make that, because it was a 6-month deferral to come back to the main board. So I come back that afternoon straight to my unit, spoke to my squadron PTR. I said, you need to write me out a letter saying I'm the fittest bloke in this regiment. I've boxed, I've done like Cambrian patrol. I said, like, people need to know I'm a fit bloke. This is the first time I've been told I'm not fit enough.
Yeah.
And so he wrote me I wrote a really good letter and he signed it off.
He agreed.
Sent it off to ASB and they withdrew the deferral and said, yeah, come back to main board.
So I've noticed a bit of a theme here.
Challenge policy.
It's a really good trait to have. And
being a military, you've got to do it in the right way.
Yes. Massively. Yeah. Depending on the structure. I mean, even civvy street, you've got to do it in the right way and you've got to go around it the right way and you've got to make sure you're correcting your facts. But obviously, challenging policy is a good thing. But what I've noticed is you get a bit of a kick out of being told you can't do something.
Massive.
You know, whether that's straight away from the army,
yeah,
you can't do this, or obviously people back in the day would have said, there's no way you're losing the weight, no way you're running the marathon, no way you're doing this, no way you're doing that. Not going to be able to box really because you need to be able to be away for a long period of time. So all these things adding up, is that something that at the time does fuel you, or you reckon that is a fueling factor now?
Massively, like, and I've probably not thought about it consciously until you've just said it then, but yeah, you're right. I always look at whatever way you can do something. So if someone says it's black and white, the reality is, as I said at the start, I'm quite a black and white person, but the reality is, it's not always black and white.
Mm-hmm.
And there are ways, I just think if you're motivated, you can do anything. I just can sound so cliche to everyone listening, and that kind of style of, you know, you can do anything if you put your mind to it. Well, you can. Like, if it's something physical you can't do, then you learn to do it physically. Yeah. I don't understand why people say
that.
Yeah,
I'm the same, mate. It might take you longer, yes, because of different things. It might be harder for you to do, yes.
Yeah.
But you can still achieve it. You know, those blokes with no legs that have got to the top of Everest.
Absolutely.
Was it easy? No. Was it harder than an able-bodied person? 100% definitely. Did they still do it? They did.
Yeah.
So that sort of carries us into you've started Sanders. So,
So I went back to main board after that deferral. Passed main board with flying colours. So they do the good man test. So on the individual exercises, like leadership exercises out on like ropes and planks and that, as the leader's taken away, they ask who they would take to Sandhurst with them out of the group of eight. And out of the group of eight that I had, all seven said they'll take me, and I was candidate number one. So that goes massively for you. So for me, that was the demonstration of like leadership. I played the game. Everyone plays a game.
Is that like a peer appraisal?
Yeah, exactly. Your Slater mate or whatever it's called.
Yeah.
But for me, I played that. Like, of course, I manipulated that situation because you want everyone to say that.
Yeah.
And anyone that says, oh, they just naturally do, you know,
bollocks.
Load of bollocks. So that got me through, right? But they gave me another deferral because they said I didn't have the education. And the education officer who...
So finally it's got up to you, the two GCSEs.
Finally got up. So literally, like, they're holding a green and a red stamp, you know, essentially in their hand. And the red one was about to come down because the education officer, who is a retired colonel, and anyone that's been through Army Officer Selection Board in the last 25 years is still the same bloke, sat there and said, because I didn't have GCSEs or A-levels, that I wasn't deserving of being an officer in the Army. And that's his exact words. And I said, with the honestly greatest respect, you have no idea what I've vocationally done in life. You have no idea my leadership capabilities based on a piece of paper that says whether I've got GCSEs or not. So I left the room thinking that was it. And this late entry major, so a guy who served 22 years in the ranks and then commissioned after, tattoos all up his arms, big unit, from the ETS, the education guys in the Army, who he obviously got it because he was a late entry, he knew what, you know, soldier
knew the crack,
like,
yeah.
Knew it. He was like, come over here, number one. We sat down in his office and we had a good long chat. He had a look at my results and got the old green stamp out and said, there's your waiver. And that was it. And I was off to Sandhurst. And that was like, for me, I was like, another goal, done, bang.
I think that's a two-pronged lesson there. One lesson is, avoid that situation in the first place. Stay in school, kids.
Go to school, kids.
And if you don't stay at school and you don't do well at school, use your time later on to build some qualifications around you.
Yeah.
Don't just expect it to fall in your lap. No. But also, don't, because you don't have those qualifications, see that as a restricting factor. There is other ways of getting that experience and proving yourself. And that's an example. This is a very good example of that. That, you know, if you do leave school without what you hope, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're stuck in a rut and you're stuck in a certain route. And again, it's worth just acknowledging that at the same time all this was going on, you were working a full-time job.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think this is a good time now. So you're at Sandhurst.
Yep.
Without going into too much detail, because the bank's boring compared to the Army stuff. Where are we level playing field in terms of that sort of timeline? How are we getting on with the bank and the personal life? Where are we?
Yeah. So the bank. So I quickly kind of went up the grades in the bank, so like up the ranks as such. So I was on a really good income, like let's say 2012, 2013. So that was taking care of everything. You know, Mrs. and I saved for a house, both equally. You know, back then in 2015, I think we put down like an 11 grand deposit for a 200 grand house, but we saved every penny for it. We moved in, took her away, we got engaged, saved for that as well, got married in 2017. So civvy life, I was ticking all the boxes, but a bank gave me the ability to do that because my bank was paying me a good salary so I could crack on and do all the stuff. Like, because of like my upbringing and that and the family life, morally for me, I'm quite a traditional bloke. So I'm not saying, you know, everyone must be married before having kids, but my goal was buy a house.
That's what you wanted.
Absolutely. Get married, have kids. Cliche, once again, it is cliche, but I think you have to work at each of those. Mm-hmm. So having a house is a reflection of your working and your savings.
Yeah.
Getting married is a reflection of like input and effort into a relationship, and having a baby kind of like solidifies that. So mm-hmm. like for me, yeah, morally, I feel like I'm just like morally telling people like the sun's just come out as well.
Yeah, I know.
Like,
no, it's weird. I was like, oh, it's like the sun just starts shining God on your boots.
God is watching. Like, oh. God is watching. Yeah, so for me, it was like, I wanted to do all that, and the bank provided all that. So I just screwed them out of the bank. Now, I'm not going to lie, like, over the last 3 or 4 years, since things have taken off with the army, I look at the bank as a job.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm lucky enough at that level where everything's fairly solid, everything's consistent. I've got flexible working, you know, I travel to Edinburgh, I travel to London, I work all over the place. But actually, my main time, it lets me invest time in the army. I do about 150, 160 days a year in the army, which is like two thirds of a full-time job. But, you know, the bank have been like so good and flexible and let me achieve all that. But for me, the bank gets some of that back.
Mm-hmm.
Leadership decisions, you know, crunch decisions, judgment, all that kind of stuff. Cliche again, it's like an army reserve habit. Yeah. But that is what it is, you know. I'm not afraid to talk to people, I'm not afraid to call people out. That's life.
And that sort of leads on to, so you did allude to earlier that, and obviously with the discussion you had with the, what was it, Lieutenant Colonel, the education officer, you've alluded to already that the skills you've developed within the bank and within the private sector and working have definitely helped you to get you are where you are now.
Yep.
As a troop commander.
Yeah.
Do you think that it's helped the other way around as well? You know, you said that it does, but have you actually had physical things that, skills that you've learned from Sandhurst, and or is it more just personal attributes that fell in the civvy world?
No, being just a poor Tom like you were, mate, in the Royals, I won't bore you with the whole officer planning cycle thing.
Please don't.
But
essentially, my mind.
Essentially, like, the army thinks it's got this great concept called the combat estimate,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, the 7 questions of how to do planning.
Yeah.
I mean, I like to say I replicate that in civvy street, but essentially I kind of do. Like, taking that planning element into how you plan, prep, ask the right questions, request further information, you know, do some what effects you're trying to achieve, all that, it's great because that helps me bang out a board paper for the bank. Like a 10, you know, 6-10 page board paper, whatever it is, really quickly, with some really good decisions on there.
Yeah.
And civvies look at it and go, oh, how did you do that? And I'm like, easy, mate.
Yeah, it's a secret. So if you want to know, pay me more money.
Yeah. But also, it's like, but you've got to be careful. Like, you know, I went away to Sandhurst for 3 months, essentially, on the commissioning course short. And then I commissioned, and then on the Saturday and on the Monday, I walked back into the bank.
Mm.
And it's really hard to come out of that military environment for a long time and not call people see you next Tuesdays because they haven't done something quick enough.
Yeah.
So the bank does benefit, but sometimes I've really got to tailor my moving from A to B.
And how do you find that transition? Because obviously a lot of Marines that I speak to or ex-service people speak to, that's where they find the biggest issue is when they transition from a military establishment and they come into a civvy workplace and everyone that's expected to do XYZ don't always do XYZ.
No.
And in that old world, if they weren't doing it, you could call them whatever you want and say, get your shit together, go and do it. And they'd have to do it. In the civvy world, that's different. Now, the difficulty comes with trying to transition and accept that and working with that to your abilities. Now, you have to do that every single day because you'll go to work with your one job, have to deal with it one way, and then come into this world with the army and have to do it a different way. How do you balance those out? Is that something that you learn?
Yeah, I think, honestly, I think like that's a mega question, but I don't think I've got an answer for it. Like, I think it's like a bit of adaptability, but it's that motivation and that speed of doing stuff. You can do that in anything, right? And I think that's what I just try and do is I try and keep a core set of skills in the army and a core set of skills in the bank that I don't have to transition. I can just, I can do it in both. It's just refining it and realising you can't thrash people in city street. I mean, really, as a trooper, you're not really supposed to be thrashing people now in the army. But but essentially, it's like that. It's just, I think it's just that, what is it that's common for both that I can just adapt with? And also, it's like, I talk to so many people, like especially in reserve now, like loads of people join the reserve ex-race because there's a lot of financial incentive and they've got so much to experience. And what I speak to loads of them and some, you know, officers who've done 8 or 12 years tend to try and go and work in the city, and lads who've come out try and then go to, you know, manual jobs, and they do think it's greener on the other side, like grass is greener, and actually it's not always, but they always say something is just like, you're not part of something like that in city
street. You miss something, yeah.
Yeah, like, you know, great, we're sitting in like a mess now, but you know, I'm lucky to be part
of lovely Chesterfields.
Lovely, mate. Yeah, mate, we'll have those in the back of the van, won't we? Yeah, like, it's just being part of something in the army, isn't it? Like, or the forces.
Yeah,
like,
belonging to something.
Yeah, regardless, because you know what? When you are living in the field, you're an exarge or an ox or whatever for 7-9 days at a time, and shitting in a bag, and, you know, whatever, you're coming out with the dirtiest jokes and the mongiest things with your mates. But you can't do that in TV streets.
Yeah, you've got to take that in. Yeah, in a professional environment at a bank, that's not going to be frowned upon. So we are getting to the point now where we're both going to be starting to get pressed for time. So let's get a little bit more into current time really now. So you've commissioned at Sandhurst, which people that don't know this, sort of most of my listeners are from the military world, so they sort of know what Sandhurst is, but it's officer training for any kind of hats. that's, you know, it's officer training, and then you came back and you're working in your regiment now, which is where we're sitting. So day to day, you work at the bank. I know you're catching a flight later. You're meant to be working at the bank. You're catching a flight later, so you are grafting late tonight anyway. And you are, we discussed earlier off air, you've got other business ideas as well. How much of that do you want to go into?
Let's go,
hit me with it.
So what is it?
What's happening now?
February 2020. So, okay, number one is just sold my current house to buy a new house in Essex. So I'm going from a 3-bedroom semi to a 4-bedroom detached, double garage, office, quality place, ensuite. It's great for me, the missus, and Milo, my dog. So we've got that. So that's literally happened like last week. Just had another job interview within the bank, waiting to literally hear out today whether I've got that. So we'll see if that happens, that comes through. If it doesn't, I've still got my status quo, so I'm happy. Army-wise, yeah, troop commander, due to pick up hopefully in the next few months, but I've got my next goal for that. I know where I want to be in 12 to 18 months' time. I want to be badged with wings, so that's my... we've got in this call, we've got a little link into the airborne brigades. So that's my next thing. I've got to have that next thing to go for again. I've got to go. I've got something that's going to get me up at 5:30 every morning with a kit on my back to go running. Simple as that.
On that one, before we carry on, do you have to go through depot and then P company?
No.
Is it worked differently?
So I'll go on all arms P company.
Right.
That's the plan. That's the plan. So I'll do it.
So all arms, the plan is to go all arms P company, get your wings, get your... do you get your beret as well? Do you only wear the beret if you're working 16 hours?
Yeah.
So, and then you'll stay within the RLC, but working in our, or is that just...
We'll see. Okay. Depends who's listening, but essentially, hopefully I'm off to Brecon soon to do...
it's my podcast, mate. Assume no one's listening.
So off to Brecon soon, hopefully, to do a couple of infantry courses, and then if I get P company, get P company in the next 12, 18 months, that then gives me a skill set to then... go to a regiment of choice. Doesn't have to be Paris, but because you've got an arduous course or whatever.
Possibly leave the world of crap hats. It's a nice world, mate. I've been in that world.
Stackers and drivers. This is great. Don't you worry about that.
Awesome. Okay. Yeah. Sorry. So back on to where we are now. That's the goal.
So that's the next physical goal. And then the missus and I, Nikki and I, are expecting our first baby in July.
Very exciting.
It's going to be different. Everyone tells me it's going to be different. And then, as well, on top of that, we've just started up a business for buy-to-let properties. So for me, I don't want to be doing civvy work for much longer. I want every opportunity I can to do full-time work for the forces, whether that's full-time reserve or whether there's, in this day and age, you can in and out of regular postings as a reserve. Luckily, I've got a good set of qualms behind me. So to do that, to achieve our goal, really, I've got to do that in the next 5 to 7 years. So I've got to have a business that can pay the financial...
Sustain that.
Because anyone that's been in the forces know that the pay isn't fantastic or equivalent. So that's where we are. I think the biggest thing for me right now is babies on the way. So, you know, I'm essentially project planning that to the much delight of the wife. And that's it, mate.
Yeah.
And a flight to catch to Edinburgh in a few hours.
Nice.
Never ends, mate. Yeah. Never ends. And why should it? Why should it be?
Exactly.
Gym every morning, run 5 times a week, 6 times a week if I'm not away with the army. Mate, just yeah.
So as we're getting into the deeper side of it now, you are doing a lot, you do a lot, and you've done a lot for a long period of time. How do you manage the three big things? So you've got the three big things in my mind are always health and fitness, personal and social, and professional. So you've really got a lot of those things mixtured, don't they? They mix quite well, because in the army, there's a big social aspect to it.
Yep.
Especially as an officer, you have certain things you have to attend. Then you've got your social life, which again mixes into that, but it's also work colleagues, army colleagues, that kind of thing. You know, that triangle of personal and social, trying to keep up with the life of having kids, Milo. I don't know why I mentioned Milo before, Nicky.
He's a legend, mate.
That's
he's a legend.
Take that from what you will, Nick. Sorry.
We'll get a picture of him uploaded as well.
Yeah, yes, definitely. So those, how do you balance all three at the moment, and is that a learning curve?
Are you sure you haven't been to Sandhurst? Are you not talking of something called Maslow's hierarchies of needs?
No, mate, I'm definitely not talking about... It's probably the same theory.
Go and Google Maslow, right? So, at Sandhurst, this is one thing I struggled with, was the whole lecture thing. I just wanted to get out in the field and dig holes. Like, mm-hmm. I was happy with that. But in the lectures, they talk about human hierarchical needs. So, like, social acceptance, financial, and stuff like that. It's called Maslow. Mm-hmm. Have a little Google.
It's done the Pudgy hierarchy. It's the triangle, mate. Pudgy triangle. That's what it is.
Yeah, so I think there's one thing missing from that triangle for me, and that is kind of social stuff. So we said like earlier, we don't catch up a lot. I don't catch up a lot with anyone or everyone as much as I should, because actually between this, which, you know, some people call a hobby, fair enough. I see it as a professional part-time career. Yeah. With the working for the bank and travelling there, also having a wife and a baby on the way, things have to give. It's not that I'm not a sociable person, but you're right. You know, if I go away with the army, there's always a few mess nights to be had, and that's great. And some of them are mates, some of them are colleagues. That's great. Mrs. and I, we still go out a lot. You know, we still have our date nights. We still have everything like that. So I'm more than happy there. I think it is a balance, but it's also a routine. Like, yeah. People say don't get in a routine, but I'm a massive advocate of a routine.
Yeah.
I get up at, you know, 4:45 every morning or whatever, because I know that I've got to be in the gym at a certain time to be ready for work, civvy work, or army work at a certain time. I fit my runs around essentially my diary. Mm-hmm. So I've always got an hour to a 2-hour block every day, civvy work or army work, where I will go for a run, because it's just blocked in, you know, shit bust. And then, you know, as far as I'm concerned, Nikki and I, we have all our time in the evenings, weekends, when I'm about. And there's another mutual person we know, Jeff, who's
a legend.
Legend, that is Jeff. Jeff, you're going to listen to this, mate, because I'm going to tag you in this so you can listen to it in your car.
He doesn't know how podcasts work, surely.
No, he doesn't. He probably just mashes the keypads with his hands.
He's probably got he's probably got tape still in his car, isn't it?
I think he listens to The Archers, actually, on Radio 4. But we're talking about everyone gets a pound of flesh.
Yeah.
That's the way I look at it.
Yeah. Like,
you know, if you cut me three ways, everyone should get an equal distribution. Mm-hmm. That's going to change when we have a baby, but like, that's the way I look at it. And the only other thing is, I'm not an emotional bloke. I don't have qualifications, but I try and build on resilience. Like, resilience, mental resilience is the biggest thing. And, all right, this is going to sound cliche as fuck, right? I was at a conference a couple of months ago, just before Christmas, with the bank, and one of the guest speakers was an ex-SF operator who does the circuit on motivational speaking. And he essentially said, and I totally agree with it, and I've never been able to word how I felt before, but I'm the gatekeeper of my emotions, right? Mm-hmm. You can do what you like to piss me off, upset me, annoy me, hurt me, and I will get upset, annoyed, pissed off, whatever, but I will release that at a place and time of my choosing, and I'm massively believing that, and because of that essentially means I can manage all three of those elements that says I can be happy when I choose to be happy. If I want to be upset, I'll be upset, but actually I'll choose when that happens. And I tailor it to my social, my work, my family, whatever.
I think that's, I mean, that triangle that I talk about, so professional, health and well-being, fitness, whatever you want to call it, and social, it's not a equilateral triangle, whatever they are. It's not a normal triangle.
Sorry, did you listen to the start of the podcast, mate? I didn't do well at school.
Neither did I. I can't even use words.
Don't use big words.
It's not an even triangle. You know, for every different person, it's going to be different. And it's really hard to get the perfect triangle, but it's got to be the perfect triangle for you. You know, if you're more into the physical side, the well-being side, if you meditate, if you do all that crap, then you're going to lean more into the health and well-being side. That might also link in with your profession, or it might not. Your profession might lack on that side. You know, you might take a lower income because you want to concentrate more on that personal health and wellness. Or you might sacrifice a bit of personal health and wellness to spend more time going out. You're a bit more of a booze hound. You like your parties, you know. Neither one is more important than the other. It's what finds works for you. So at the moment, you would say you spend a lot of time working on your professionalism and the sort of a mixture of the hobbies, wellness, that kind of thing, because of this Army Reservist thing. Yeah. And the thing that falls down the most that you wish you had more time for is the social aspect.
Yeah, 100%. 100%, 100%.
There's only so many hours in the day, though, isn't there?
26.
Awesome, mate. So, next couple one then. I'm just having a little quick look at my notes because, and now I'm stalling because
I'm
trying to
read. Why are you still using crayons?
Mate,
did you get your
shit? They're tasty, mate. You know, I've got a notepad that's like half full, but it's only full of stickers.
Yeah,
awesome. So, as we said, you didn't leave school with many qualifications. You've obviously developed some qualifications through professional work and the army, which is also professional, but you know what I mean. What advice would you give to any school leavers now, whether it be university, sixth form, GCSEs, if they haven't got the qualifications they wish they had at that point?
Vocation, and that's not a program on Channel 4.
Yeah.
But vocation is so important. Like, if you can get the experience and then turn it, so the forces are great at it, you get the experience and they give you like level 5, level 6 qualifications, mm-hmm. like for certifications. Like, what that means in Civil Street, I can't tell you, but like, if you can talk a good experience, like, and you can show competency in something that you've done, then that's what you need to do. If you're leaving, like, if you're genuinely like leaving school, leaving any education, and you haven't, and it hasn't gone that well for you, that doesn't necessarily matter. Like, unless you're going to be a professional, you can still be a professional. You can still be a doctor. If I want to be a doctor, then I'll save money so I've got enough to pay my mortgage and I'll go to university next year.
Mm.
Like, that's shit bust, isn't it? Like, you can do whatever you like, but go and get experience. Like, that's so key. Anyone will employ anyone, or anyone will do anything they want if you can make a decision. And it's better to make a bad decision than no decision at all. And that is so important.
Yeah, 100%.
Just don't make that bad decision twice.
Yeah.
That.
Learn from it.
Life is that, like, for me, life is that simple.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people are scared to make decisions because they don't want to make the wrong decision. If you always see it as the wrong decision, then it's going to be bad.
Yeah.
If you see it as a learning experience, you make a decision, you get it wrong, you learn from it, and you never make that same decision again, job's good. And you make that same decision again, either you've massively messed up or misinterpreted the situation. If you make that for a third time, you're just a shit bloke. And that, you know, you've got to learn from your experiences. So no, yeah, it's just being, as you say, shit or bust.
It's that typical thing about junior officers. Junior officers always fuck up.
Yeah.
But they always keep fucking up until someone tells them not to.
Yeah.
Like, I can say that because I've been a Tom for five and a half years, but that's the thing, isn't it? So.
And it is all learning. Awesome. Obviously, a big part of who you are at the moment and takes up 200 odd days of the year, as you said, is the reservist. Now, you've had a relatively unique experience in terms of you were a private soldier, and now you're going through the officer card A, if you like, and building your way up through there. What are the pros and cons of both in terms of in the reservist areas?
So I think I'll do the cons first and I'll finish on the pros. I think the cons of being a Tom, going private, Lance Jack or whatever, is if you've got experience in civil life where you're a decision maker, those decisions aren't always in your hands in the forces. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to adapt into a scenario where you think about, like, if you're in the field and you think you can do X, Y, and Z, but your one-up is saying, I want you to do A, B, and C, you're limited into what capacity you can do, you know? And that's absolutely fine. The cons of being a junior officer is essentially I've started again.
Mm-hmm.
So unfortunately, I walk around and talk around like I'm an LE captain or an LE major, and I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm just a bod. Like, I still am just a bod. I'm still just a young troop commander. So it's frustrating that actually I've got a bit of a glass ceiling at the minute because of the way the rank system works. I think the pros of being a soldier is I think you can get away with a lot more. Like, you know, naked bars are fine. Naked bars are absolutely fine. Which is great, and you almost are expected to have an opinion opposite to the establishment.
Mm-hmm.
So you can get away with that as a junior soldier. I think the pros of being a junior officer, and I'll 100% say this, right, cliche again, we should add a bullshit buzzer at the start of this, right? But the Sandhurst motto is serve to lead. And I still think the biggest, at any rank in the army, whether it's junior NCO, senior officer, to lead people in a military environment is unlike any other leadership there is.
Mm-hmm.
And I love it, especially physically. So if you're out on a tab or you're out on whatever, leadership comes through how your blokes look at you. And you just don't get out in civil life. And mm-hmm. for me, there is a massive buzz there. And people want to listen to the decisions that I make.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the two cons, that's the two pros.
Awesome. So moving forward then, we have touched on your aims and your goals a little bit earlier, but last question pretty much. What is the vision of James in 10 years? Where are we looking? 10 years time, what are you doing?
10 years time, walked away with a redundancy package from the bank.
Nice.
Pays a mortgage for a few years. Full-time in the forces, whether it's a full-time reserve contract or I found myself some specialist job that people already employed me for. Like to be a major, dad of 2 kids.
Still including Milo?
3 kids including Milo. That guy's infinite, so he's been gone forever. Yeah,
we're not even going to bother. Carry on.
Definitely still happily married to Nikki. And just like still physical stuff. So there's a lot of challenges that are physical challenges, like the Marathon du Sable and some of the stuff across the Great Wall of China, some of the deserts of America. I think there's so much more to explore physically in endurance events. I want to do that. I think that's it really. I say that's it. It's probably a lot to tick off in the next 8 to 10 years. Just carrying on. Nikki said to me a few weeks ago, she was like, "Are you ever going to stop?" I was like, "I don't want to. I don't want to stop." It's just always an upward trend. Like, just keep going up. What's next? Everything is doable. Everything's doable. And it's like, it's not having a bucket list. It's like having a list of stuff you have done, not awesome, stuff mate. You want to do.
Awesome. I think anyone listening to this, whether it's going to be reservists, old friends of mine and yours, people that, you know, are in the military, want to be in the military or stuff like that, or even in some sort of leadership role within a professional environment, everyone can listen to this and take something from it. So really appreciate you coming on, mate. Thank you very much. Didn't swear too much. Good work.
I thought I did. Shit.
Just get one in there before the end. Thanks for coming on The Working Title. Cheers, man.
Thanks for listening to another episode of The Working Title, a podcast hosted by PJ Harries. Remember, do something that makes you just a little bit better every single day.